Hi everyone, I'm Vande Sujata and I'm here to talk for a little while on the topic of conceit. And conceit is one of the core sort of dhammas, core states that the Buddha asked us to investigate and to understand. And it is something that plays a central role in our spiritual path and our spiritual progress. But I think that there are things about this and about how this works that we haven't, that we don't necessarily notice, and that we, I suspect that understanding it or reflecting on it is essential to being able to make any steps forward. Now, the toxic side effects of conceit are easily seen within spiritual communities. There's so many spiritual teachers who are sort of going on about states that they haven't realized or attained. There are, you know, forums and communities are full of students and practitioners who imagine that they have this jhana or this state of awakening or that state of awakening. And it's really characteristic of the spiritual path and Buddhist community as a whole. Painful. It's painful to see how these teachings, which are intended for us to let go of conceit, in fact just become reified into conceit about our spiritual path. But I think that there's something more subtle about it that I'm trying to figure out. I'm trying to reflect on, trying to make sense of for myself. You see, I think that we as progressives, or we as people who want to make a positive change in the world, I think that in many important ways that we failed. And we have tried to do a lot of good things that we think are good. Some of those things, of course, we've succeeded in. In many ways, the world has got a lot better in a short time. I don't want to discount that or to marginalize it. In terms of acceptance of same-sex relationships or recognition of the harm that racism does, and so on. We haven't by any means got rid of these problems, but at least there's, I think, some progress and some recognition of the issues. But at the same time, there's a lot of cases where there doesn't seem to be much progress. I mean, we're now facing the prospect of an election in the US where we're going to choose between two old white men who are both sexual harassers. It's not to make a false equivalence. Donald Trump is a rapist, a child abuser, a monster, a deranged, narcissistic fool who puts the world in peril every day. Joe Biden is a old guy without much ideas who puts his hands on women in inappropriate ways, and if he was to apologize and come forward and say, this is what I did, I've changed, it was wrong, wouldn't do it again, then probably it would be okay. But what you see, in fact, is not that's happening, but you see the usual kinds of denial and so on that's happened, and the sad sight of the women in the progressive movement having to bear the burden once more of apologizing for and sticking up for the man who's been misbehaving. And of course, the saying is always, well, believe women, but, you know, maybe not this woman this time. In the Vinaya, one of the things which is not so noted or not so remarked upon, you see lots of people find opportunities to say the Vinaya is very sexist. But one of the rules which people have overlooked a lot is the rules they call the Aniyata rules. And the Aniyata rules are essentially Me Too rules, and they say that if any trustworthy laywoman makes an accusation against a monk, then that accusation must be followed up, and if the monk is guilty, then the monk must be treated according to the accusation. This is very progressive. This is still doesn't happen in so many places. It's still not happening today in the Democrat Party in the United States. Of course, doesn't happen within Buddhism either, but at least we can see that the Buddha wanted it to happen. So what's going on here? Well, this is the way, one of the ways that conceit works, that those who are in positions of power imagine that they have some right to that power and that what they're going to do is somehow intrinsically good based on their own inherent worthiness of wielding that power. And others believe them. Others believe the one who has power. And so this is a kind of inverted conceit. The one who's in the top has a conceit about that they can do things, and the other ones have this projection of the conceit on top of them. I'm sorry about the noise in the background. Somebody's doing the vacuuming in the hallway outside our little flat. I think that's quite nice. Thank you, person who's doing the vacuuming. It's a Saturday morning now. I guess people are at home. People are home anyway in the pandemic, so I guess people are home more than ever. So I could stop this talk and start it again or edit that bit out, but I think I'll leave it there just as a thank you for the working people who are keeping things clean and looking after the place for us. So this thing of conceit. Now, I think that progressives, like people like myself, I count myself as a progressive, I think that we suffer from a rather insidious form of conceit. And I think that this underlies a lot of the failure that we've had. There was a brilliant essay a couple of years ago by an essayist called Hamilton Nolan, who wrote about why progressives fail because they have serially compromised on what they believe in. And we've known all along what are the things that we value, but we have been prepared to be realistic, to compromise, to settle. And along the way, we've somehow forgotten to have integrity, to have a sense of moral values. We have become so used to settling for the Joe Bidens of this world that we forget that this really isn't what we wanted. And as a result of that, our voices have become insincere and corrupted, and no one believes us. And all of this arises, I believe, because of conceit. What conceit am I talking about? Well, let me share with you something of my own kind of experience. I grew up in Perth. To me, it seems like a normal environment, I guess. Everybody's environment seems normal to them. Nice parents, nice school, nice house, nothing to complain about. I had an awakening or a moral shift, a major moral shift, when I left my school and went to university. Suddenly, much bigger universes opened up. I started reading philosophy. Well, I'd read some philosophy beforehand. But I started reading some more philosophy. I began my philosophical reading, I began with Nietzsche, which maybe explains a thing or two, I guess. So already I decided to become an atheist. I didn't, this whole God belief I thought was silly and rejected that. And I wanted to find like what's true and what's real. And I had this kind of feeling that this was something that I had to work out. I had to put effort into finding out what my own values were. And this was one of Nietzsche's major points, that we've killed God, so what is there that's going to take his place? So during my first year at uni, for a variety of reasons, I had a connection with environmentalism. Part of it was seeing the film Koyaanisqatsi, if any of you remember that, amazing nature documentary set to the music of Philip Glass. Part of it was some of the readings that I was exposed to through Peter Singer, reading about animal liberation, and various kinds of things. And so I decided to become a vegetarian. Soon after, I became a vegan. And embraced animal liberation and environmental causes and wanted to do something about it. But wanting to do something about it was coming from an underlying shift in my own moral values. And suddenly it seemed as if the world had opened up. And I could see the world through new eyes. I could see the interconnection between things. I could see the preciousness of things. I could see the harm that humanity was doing in destroying the forests. At that time, one of the big controversies was the destruction of the Daintree forest, old growth forest in Tasmania. And my inner experience of that was the experience of a transformation and a transcendence. It was the experience for me of stepping into what I felt was a better version of myself. I felt that I had grown, that the horizons that I had, moral horizons that I'd had previously, were based on a more limited consciousness. And I was stepping into a wider and bigger and better form of moral consciousness. That's how I experienced it. That's my own inner growth. And I think I was right. I absolutely think I was right. I absolutely think that that's what was going on. But then what happens? Well, what happens then is that we then think that if this has happened to me, it's going to happen for others as well. Because part of that expansion of consciousness is realizing the connection between everything. And it's realizing that we should be basing our life on love and on compassion. And so we naturally want to help others around us. And we naturally think, well, if only they were to go through that same, kind of like a conversion experience, if they were to go through the same conversion experience that I went through, then they too would be lifted up in the way that I've been lifted up. And so this is why often those conversion experiences are then accompanied by activism and wanting to change the world. You want to make you become better, and you want the world to experience what you've experienced. The problem is, of course, that the world doesn't want to. Now, of course, there are some people in certain situations who will be ready to take that step, but most people are not. After the Buddha was awakened, then, never forget, originally he didn't want to teach. Beings have too many defilements, he said. You know, there are a few who have little dust in their eyes, and it's for their sake that I'll teach. And I think sometimes we forget this wisdom of the Buddha, that what we've been through is a genuine moral progression, and not everybody is ready for that, is going to do that. It doesn't mean that they won't or that they can't. I still firmly believe that every sentient being is capable of awakening and is capable of this kind of moral expansion and moral progression. I absolutely believe that. In fact, I believe that it's normal. I believe that everybody is doing this right now. But it takes time. And the Buddhist tradition is very realistic about this. Even Devadatta will get enlightened, but, you know, give him a few thousand eons. And when we look at the world around us, actually this is the reality of the world that we live in. If we look at the people who are, the people who are voting for Donald Trump, or the people who are running, you know, death camps in Western China, or people who are, for that matter, pushing the Australian immigration, pushing the concentration camps we're keeping in offshore facilities. Are people like that, are they going to have some kind of moral epiphany anytime soon? Are they going to realize the essential interconnectedness of all beings and to realize that their love for everyone is going to transform the way that they live their life? I think they will, actually. I think all of them will, but it will take time. Not time in years or decades, but time in lifetimes, in eons. I think that's realistic. So, we've had this epiphany. We think that we've got better. And you see, here's the subtle thing. We, of course, get this conceit about that. And conceit is natural. It's okay. It's normal. We have this conceit about that. But the peculiar nature of the conceit of the progressives is this, because we fundamentally believe that all beings are equal and we believe that we should share our values and our lives of equal worth with everyone else, we don't believe that we're actually better, or at least we tell ourselves that we're not actually better. The kind of our conceit is that we are in fact better. We have in fact ascended to a higher moral plane, but we won't admit that. We lie to ourselves and we lie to everyone else and try to say, well, all opinions are valid. We try to say we should listen to all points of view. Whereas sneakily in the back of our minds, we know that I'm never going to go back there. I know what their moral values are because that's where I came from. But they don't know my moral values because they haven't grown. And do you see how this conceit is working? And this is why subtly progressives are always speaking down to people. We're always coming to them as if we have solutions, as if we have answers, as if the world would be fine so long as kind of everyone became more like us. And again, let me just say, I think that's true. I think if everybody did have an advanced moral consciousness where they recognize the interdependence of all beings, the world would be a better place. But you can see why it's not a very effective rhetorical strategy. And the fact that we have this conceit, we keep on lying to ourselves about it. This is why they hate us. And this is something that we find it really difficult to acknowledge. Many years ago, before I was a monk, I was hitchhiking in northern New South Wales. And that area is kind of the hippie belt. And I, you know, got a lift with some farmer, and you know, very kindly picked me up, and he's driving me around. And I said, "Where did you come from?" I said, "I come from Nimbin." Nimbin's a kind of the renowned hippie centre. It's where everyone grows the pot and that kind of thing. And he's like, "They should put a bomb under that place. They should put a bomb under that place." It's not like, don't you think those people are wasting their time? You know, there's too many drugs there. I mean, I think there are valid critiques to be made, but they should put a bomb under it. And this is that kind of attitude, that kind of belief that we, as progressives, have been so reluctant to admit, the extent of hate. This is what they mean when they talk about the elites. And this, the word the elites has become one of the words which has bamboozled commentators, because I mean, Trump isn't an elite, but he literally shits on a golden toilet. How is he not the elite? I mean, he was born into a millionaire's family and had millions and millions pumped into him by his father for years to fuel his criminal enterprises. And yet somehow he's not the elite. Why? Why isn't he the elite? Because he talks like us. He thinks like us. He says the same things that we say. This is what his supporters will say. And we, the progressives, are not listening to them. We think we know better. We think, look, Trump says all these things, but he doesn't mean them. He's just lying to you. You think you're going to get some benefit from what Trump's doing, but he's not going to give you jobs. He's not going to restart the factories. He's not going to do any of these things he's talking. He's just lying to you. But see, the thing is, they don't really care about that. It's not about that. It's about hurting us. It's because they've been made to feel inferior, morally and spiritually inferior, because of our conceit and our condescension. And because of that, they hate us. And they don't care if it hurts them, as long as it hurts us more. And so part of our conceit is that we have failed to acknowledge the extent and the manner of cruelty in public discourse. We never wish any harm on anyone. We just don't. We honestly are looking for win-win situations every time we want. We think that if we can move to a vegetarian diet, then we can free up farmland. We can have farm workers can work in less toxic environments. People will be healthier, less resources are required. I mean, who loses? And then people say, well, people like to eat meat. That's why we have this meat-eating culture, because people don't want to give up eating meat. But that's not really true. I mean, that's part of it. But the reason why people like eating meat is because they've been conditioned to like eating meat, because they've been acculturated towards it. Look at the advertising industry and how it's creating that kind of desire. And then that desire becomes associated with a kind of worldview, with a kind of way of seeing things. And so we have failed as progressives. We haven't convinced the world that they should be vegetarian. We haven't. The world, I think, now is using, 3% or something like that of renewable energy. We haven't come even close to making a solution for, even for climate change, one of the most obvious and imminent threats that we have. We're still seeing a playoff between sexual predators in the elections in supposedly developed countries. We still have so much left to do, even of these basic things. Like, these really basic things. I mean, how is this not, how is vegetarianism not either mandatory, or how is meat not just massively taxed to discourage it? I mean, these things should be basic in constructing a world that's livable and that's going to be manageable for the future. And yet, we've made such a little start. How are we going to do this? What solutions do we have? Well, look, I'm trying to get over this conceit thing, and so I don't really want to present a solution. I don't know if there is a solution. To say that there is a solution is to presume that there's going to be an outcome. I don't know whether there's going to be an outcome. And I think that we need to have the honesty to say, well, look, I don't know whether this will work. We need to have the honesty to say, this is where I'm at. And will the world change in that way? Are the values that I have going to contribute in a meaningful and a positive way? Maybe, maybe not. So I don't have any solutions, and I don't have any answers for anybody. But I do have a suspicion, and my suspicion is that until we can begin to acknowledge how that conceit works within ourselves, and how we see ourselves as kind of better, but also we kind of refuse to see that, and we pretend to ourselves that we see each other as equal, but in fact we know that we're actually better than others, and we're not really wanting to acknowledge that. And until we start getting to grips with that and trying to understand what that's all about, then I think that the solutions, until we can do that, then we're going to continue condescending to people, talking down to people, and we're going to continue to fail to actually make the changes that we need to make. Perhaps what is needed, if we look at how the Buddha taught and how the Buddha spoke, the Buddha was not afraid to speak to what is highest. Yes, he communicated to people on their level and he connected with people on their level, but he wasn't afraid to set some kind of aspiration. He wasn't afraid to talk to people about something that they didn't have any experience of and something that would call them out to try to live better and fuller lives. Perhaps there's something in that that's going to be of use to us to help to be able to communicate and to understand our own ideas in a better way. The Buddha was not subject to the kind of conceit that I'm talking about. He quite clearly said, I'm enlightened. I'm the foremost person. I mean, if you look at this sounds very conceited. If you or I were to say that, it would be conceited. But when the Buddha was saying it, he was merely making a statement of fact. And so for us to pretend that we're somehow worse than we are is perhaps the source of the problem. I wonder whether my understanding or analysis of this as I'm speaking, it reminds me of my understanding of the role of conceit in The Lord of the Rings and in Tolkien's work. And as a long-time Tolkien geek, perhaps that's really where I came from it. If you look at how Tolkien's understanding of pride and conceit goes, the ring, of course, is all about pride. The ring doesn't particularly do anything except for amplify the ego, and everybody who gets hold of it becomes the most egoic version of themselves. This reflects Tolkien's Catholic understanding of pride. But one of the things that happens in his books, and it happens as a regular pattern, is that people refuse to accept their genuine status because of their humility. They accept a status lower than they really are. The most obvious example is Aragorn, who lives as a humble wanderer. And it's not until he accepts that he is, in fact, the true king and steps into that role that the world can be aright. Gandalf is another example. Not obvious from the movies or whatever, but Gandalf was, in fact, always the highest of the wizards and yet accepted a humble status relative to Saruman. And so on. There are many different examples of this. So until we step into that genuine position of moral and spiritual leadership and are not afraid to say it how it is and to speak to our own moral truth, and if as long as we keep on second-guessing what are those consequences, what we can get away with, what's allowable for us to say, then our speech will always be cramped and incoherent, and it will be lacking integrity and lacking sincerity. We have to speak the truth, if nothing else. We have to say what is right and what is wrong, if nothing else. And we have to be unafraid to recognize that there are degrees of moral value and that we need, as a species, as humanity, we need that leadership to step into a higher level of moral consciousness. Otherwise, none of this is going to work out for anyone. So anyway, this is some thoughts that I had for you on the topic of conceit. And I offer this for your reflection. And